and welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I am once again not Tyler Smith.
I am David Bax. Tyler Smith is on assignment. You are who?
Scott Nye, editor at large.
Editor at large. Like I said, Tyler Smith is on assignment. That's actually kind of true this time. He's representing.
Usually it's a lie that you tell people to make Tyler's life sound more adventurous and exciting.
Yeah, but Tyler
is off in a jungle somewhere.
What's he doing?
Yeah.
Whereas usually he's what is he usually doing when we say this? He's
on vacation with family, I think.
Okay, yeah. Well, here Tyler is representing both Battleship Pretension and his other podcast, More Than One Lesson, at the International Christian Film Festival in Orlando, California. No, Orlando is in Florida.
Other side.
The Sunshine State, not the Golden State.
Kind of interchangeable, really. They should come up with better
officially
slogans.
That's their...
Yeah.
Every state has an official.
Right. But, you know, it's pretty interchangeable.
Yeah. What's Massachusetts?
I don't remember. I lived there for 4 years. I have no idea.
Okay. What's Oregon?
No idea. Beaver State?
That sounds right. I'm from St. Louis, the show me state. St. Louis is not the name of the state. Missouri is, but there was a cord in my way.
The show me state?
The show me state.
Like, yes. Show me the money?
That's not where it comes from.
Right.
But it is one of those things.
I'm making sure I get the spelling right.
Yeah, it is one of those things where people, like, there's not really a hard and fast story of where it comes from. But the basic idea is that Missourians aren't going to believe, they're not going to take you at your word.
Okay.
It's like, I need to see the proof is the idea. I don't think that actually holds true of most Missourians, especially as they become more and more Fox Newsy.
Right.
In the time that I've left.
Sure.
But
I like to imagine that somebody was setting up Missouri and just trying to sell it to people. And as people are coming in, they're like, all right, show me. And that's where that got started. A bunch of very skeptical people gradually being sold on Missouri.
Yeah. You know what? That's probably how people still react to Missouri, and St. Louisans definitely have a chip on their shoulder about it.
I've been to St. Louis. It's okay.
No, St. Louis is great. It's a great place to be from. It's a lot of history.
Yeah.
It was the gateway to the West.
So I've heard.
So the beginning of the Lewis and Clark Trail.
Yeah. All of these things that make very apparent.
And also obviously home of the St. Louis Cardinals,
obviously
the second most winning team in Major League Baseball. Anyway, okay. We're way off track.
That's how it goes.
Also, home of the St. Louis Blues, who are currently, as of this recording, knotted up at 2 games apiece with the Dallas Stars in the second round of the NHL playoffs. Go Blues. And also, go to tweakedaudio.com. Tweakedaudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great and they sound great. And Tyler and I use them each and every day of our lives. We got to get you a pair.
I have one somewhere. Don't listen to a lot of music on earbuds right now because I don't listen at work.
You probably can't. Yeah.
Can't.
I listen all day at work. That's when I do my listening. And I don't know what I was listening to. You know what? In anticipation of Rocket Man coming out at the end of the month, I was listening to Elton John today, and it sounded great on my tweet.
You didn't need to bring in a probably bad movie and an excuse to listen to Elton John.
No, that's true. I listen to Elton John a lot
because
he's fantastic. It was one of the first things my mom and I like agreed on. Like as I got old, when I was young, I didn't like Elton John.
Right,
I was like, oh, Can You Feel the Love Tonight?
Yeah.
Bullshit.
Totally.
Or whatever, you know? And then I was like too punk for it.
Right.
And then like, as I got into realizing that, like the, especially like the early Elton John, you know, is really good stuff.
Yeah.
And basically my mom, like the two CDs that were, had the most rotation in my mom's car, were Elton John's Greatest Hits and ABBA's Greatest Hits, which is
right on,
both fantastic.
Right.
And so that was something after an entire childhood of me not liking anything my mom listened to.
Yeah.
She liked, my mom also likes Andrew Lloyd Webber and Jesus Christ Superstar.
Okay.
I like some show tunes. I've never been an Andrew Lloyd Webber guy.
I'm with you there.
And so that was I think even as a teenager when I was like getting into musicals and she was like, oh, you should listen to Jesus Christ Superstar. I think she was like disappointed that I didn't like it.
Understandably. finally thought her punk son was developing taste. Turns out.
No, punk rock is where I got my taste.
Okay.
Cause
I'm saying from her perspective.
Yeah. Anyway, But it sounded good in my tweakedaudio.com earbuds. They're available at a low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Now, Scott, this is normally the point where I would ask Tyler to introduce our guest, but I think I'm going to take the reins here.
Yeah, to be honest, I forgot his name until I walked off. I was like, I probably would look up his name.
I do know his name. I did, however, forget the name of his book.
It's quite long.
The subtitle is very long.
But you've written a book that is for cinephiles who listen to this show. The part that's important is that it has a lot to do with a underseen in the U.S. 1976 documentary called El Desencanto, or The Disenchantment. The movie is now playing, it's touring around with you pretty much around the U.S. playing at different places now. You wrote a book about it. I'm sure you'll tell us the name of the book in a second. And your name is Aaron Shulman. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for sitting quietly while Scott and I talk some bullshit for five minutes.
No problem.
Sorry, remind me of the name of the book.
Yeah, my book is called The Age of Disenchantment, The Epic Story of Spain's Most Notorious Literary Family in the Long Shadow of the Spanish Civil War. Bit of a mouthful.
So, luckily, Scott and I... Scott Nye is his name.
It's
Scott
a and common I. problem with people saying yeah. that.
Scott and I Scott Nye, have seen the movie but not read the book. So, but you know what? We'll get into the book and movie questions later. I want to get to know Aaron first. So where are you from?
I am from the Great Lakes State.
Michigan?
Yeah.
Right. Part of Michigan. My dad's from Michigan.
Hazlitt, which is right next to East Lansing. So,
well, you got to show us on the myth. Yeah. You got to do
right
that.
There, right there. All right. Nice little sweet spot.
Sure. My dad's from Grand Rapids.
All right.
Yeah.
East Lansing, good film festival.
Yeah, I'm screening El Desencanto with them in June for any listeners in Michigan.
Yeah, I know that's a, I don't know why East Lansing has a film festival that like is so rich in like experimental short film and stuff like that. I'm not sure why that is. But I've often gone to back when I've kind of fallen off going to LA Film Forum a lot, but like there'd be like a night of short films and I'll be like premiered at East Lansing. That's like why I know that's the Lansing Film Festival. Also that's where, Richard Linklater's Tape.
Huh.
It takes place in Lansing because the what's his name from Dead Poets Society, that actor
Ethan Hawke.
No, the other one, Robert Sean Leonard.
Sure,
he's a filmmaker who's there with a film. Okay. That's the premise. He's back in town with a film. Anyway, it's so. Did you? Is that how you got into movies? Going to the Lansing Film Festival?
No, I don't know how I got into movies. I think it was the boredom of growing up in Michigan, and so you look for things to do. Yeah, and I remember watching. Somehow, I think we went to the video store without my mom and got Kids when I was 12, and then my mom was really upset when she found out we'd watch it. So a lot of that kind of thing, a lot of movie watching in the basement because there was nothing else to do.
I remember asking my mom if I could see Kids, and she was like, "What is it?" And so
it's about kids.
I tried to explain it in the terms of, I was like, "Well, it's rated R." But in terms of like, it's a,
was it rated? I wasn't.
It might have been unrated or NC-17 or something. But I was like, I was not allowed to watch. Or my parents were very strict. But I was like trying to sell it in terms of like it's an important like social drama. Mm-hmm. It's about issues that kids face. And my mom was like, "Well, maybe we should watch it together." And I suddenly lost interest in seeing.
Yeah, kids. Remarkable that's how that
good,
turns around.
That's a good technique. She knew what she was doing.
Yeah. And so, what brought you to California?
What brought me to California? I was living in Spain in 2012.
Oh, so I skipped an interesting part.
Yeah. Well, that's actually, and that I had actually just discovered El Desencanto, but my wife and I were, we were living in Madrid. The economic crisis there was, Spain was really just, it was a hard place to be at that time. And then my wife's green card had just come through. And so we moved to LA. We were here for 5 years. We had some friends here, but I also had a brief flirtation with screenwriting, which actually happened when I was in Spain. It started. I wrote a screenplay with my best friend who had gone to the UCLA mm-hmm. MFA program, and sort of like, I was just like, we were living in a tiny studio in Madrid. I was completely broke, and then wrote this screenplay on a lark. And then we suddenly had like a manager, an agent, and a lawyer, and I flew here for like a week of meetings, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to be like, like rich in no time. So when it was time for us to leave Spain, we looked at a couple different places, settled on LA. We were kind of between New York and LA, and everyone just seemed happier in LA, or even with everyone was like, yeah, I'm still miserable, but it's sunny when you go outside.
Yeah.
So we decided
that's why like New York loves to talk shit. New Yorkers love to talk shit about Angelinos. San Franciscans love to talk shit about Angelinos, but we're too happy.
To talk shit about anybody. Yeah.
We're like, because Los Angeles people, the LA San Francisco thing is a big thing where San Franciscans are like, oh, fucking Los Angeles. And Angelinos are like, oh, we love San Francisco. We love going up there. It's because we're happier here. We don't have that chip on our shoulder. I loved it.
I lived here for 5 years and completely loved it. And the screenwriting thing didn't work out. I just couldn't really, it just wasn't for me. All the meetings and mm-hmm. all the bullshit just wasn't my thing. And I had always been a book guy first, even though I was, had, really loved, movies. And then this book kind of came together. I found a publisher and I turned to that. Although I'm going to be writing a pilot of my book
for
a producer we're looking at a sort of international kind of production, now that Roma has done so well and it's kind of Spanish language drama like that seems viable, and Netflix just bought the rights to 100 Years of Solitude.
Okay.
That it seems like there's some possibilities. So I'll write the pilot and then who knows what the hell happened.
So the pilot is about the Pinero family?
Yeah. So that's it's almost like we're pitching it. It's kind of like, they're not a crime family, but how the Godfather is this really powerful story. It's about crime and it's about a time and a place, but it's also just about family.
Yeah.
This book, my book's about poetry. It's about Spanish history, but also it's just about a family navigating the times.
Yeah. It also, the Godfather makes sense, but there's a lot of Royal Tenenbaums
connections
you could make with this family.
Definitely. It is kind of like Royal Tenenbaums or the Glass family from Salinger. Totally.
So how'd you come to this family as a topic for the book?
So we were living in Madrid in 2012 and we'd been in Spain. My wife and I met in Guatemala. Then we'd been in Spain for about 3 years. And my friend Javi, who's actually a judge, but his sort of secret life is he's the most obsessive cinephile that I know. And so we'd known each other for a while now, and he knew I was really into books, really into movies. So he's like, you invited us over one day to his house to just watch this documentary. He's like, I don't want to tell you that much. It's about this crazy family of poets. It's a kind of famous film in Spain, and I think you're going to like it. And so we would just watch his apartment, and I was just sort of came out of there like, what the hell was that? It's just this eccentric family. They all speak brilliantly. They're deeply fucked up. Uh-huh. And, as it turns out, it had played a really important historical role in Spain transitioning to democracy. So I just was like, what is this? And I was also reading, I don't know if you've read any Roberto Bolaño, this Chilean novelist who wrote Savage Detectives, 2666, in the last 15 years English.
I've
He's been this huge writer who writes about sort of crazy poets and fascists and history. And I felt like the movie was like a Bolaño novel. And so I actually went home and first thing I did was Googled Bolaño and El Desencanto. And then it turned out Bolaño had actually fictionalized one of the sons in a couple of his novels. Oh. So where I was thinking, this felt like something stolen from Bolaño's imagination. Bolaño had stolen from some aspects of this movie. So from there I just got, yeah, I just got super obsessed. I wrote a piece for The Believer magazine about El Desencanto, and I interviewed the director and a couple other people. And from there, over a couple more years, I sort of realized, like, am I writing a book about this? And I was.
Well, let's for the listeners, let's take a step back. Who was Leopoldo Panero, and who are the family?
Right. Yes. Yeah. And just kind of the film. So Leopoldo Panero was a Spanish poet. He was a communist poet before the Spanish Civil War. So in the 1930s in Madrid, he was friends with Pablo Neruda, Federico Garcia Lorca, all these big guys in this very vibrant, mostly leftist scene in Madrid. So then there, you know, Franco and other generals rose up against the Republic. Leopoldo Panero was caught outside of Madrid in one of the territories that went to Franco. So what a lot of people, I mean, geography sort of determined your destiny in a lot of ways of where you got caught. And that was the case with Leopoldo Panero. His brother joined up with Franco's forces just out of, you know, a survival need. Mm-hmm. And then Leopoldo Panero didn't, and he ended up getting taken to jail and was on the verge of being executed, except that his mother was a distant cousin of Franco's wife. Oh, so wow. Got him out right before he was executed. And then he joined Franco's army in order to survive. But then by the end of it, either out of, you know, sort of this comradeship or survival and pragmatism, or some sort of seduction toward the other side, he was writing fascist poetry by the end of the war. And then gradually, although he didn't support, he wasn't a fascist in the sense of supporting the Nazis. He was actually rooting for the British during the World War II because he had studied there in college. But he gradually over the years rose up the ranks in the Franco cultural establishment, you know, like as a poet who's celebrated for conservative poetry about, you know, for the family and God and the nation. And then he was also kind of an art czar who was running literary magazines and kind of diplomatic gatherings of artists and writers. So that's who he was, the legacy. And then he married a woman named Felicidad Blanc, who was this known throughout Madrid. She grew up from a wealthy family in Madrid and was known for being really beautiful. But she was just this very sort of, she was a dreamer who was so in love with reading that she really just wanted life to be the novel that it wasn't. And so then it was sort of like this, they were very badly matched, I think, as a married couple, but very well matched as literarily. So he was a guy who liked to romanticize life just like she did. And so he was looking for a muse. She was sort of the process of being transformed into a poem completely seduced her. And so they got married and had a very unhappy marriage and produced three very unhappy children so the Desencanto is 12 years after Leopoldo Panero's death in 1962. In 1974, mom and the three sons get together and they air all the dirty laundry from the family. They tell the real story about the father. They tell some lies. There's some competing narratives, and it's just, I'd be curious what your guys' impression. I've seen it so many times and context.
The thing I want to mention is that these interviews with the directors, Jaime Chavarri, is happening, or at least the movie makes it seem that it's happening at the time of the dedication of a statue of Leopoldo Panero in the town Agrosta?
Astorga.
The other time is, it's 12 years after Panero has died, but it's right after Franco died, right?
Or so they were filming right before and as he was dying, basically. Okay. And then the film came out right the year after he died, which we can come to later, kind of defined the way the film was received.
Yeah, it certainly informed the way that I watched it. Scott and I watched the movie not together, separately, I thought it was really fascinating, very very funny in a dark, hilarious, sad way. And I almost had to remind myself as a documentary, because I feel like there are so many movies about like, I guess you'd call these people aristocrats.
They're sort of maybe like intellectual or artistic aristocrats. Right. They no longer had any money, and that's sort of like this. It's just right. a family in decline, but they definitely have the air of aristocrats.
And, yeah, so. And I feel like so many movies about 20th century aristocrats or people like that have the, one of the things that the families trade in or thrive on is an ability to be almost emotionlessly cruel to one another. Yeah, yeah. to be in a weird way very self-aware and self-assessing, mm-hmm. but also not really willing to do anything about it, as if
right.
from an intellect, as if the intellectualism is in itself, like
right.
recognizing the way that I am terrible or the way that my my upbringing is terrible is enough,
right?
And yeah. and just talking about it is all we're going to do. We're not going to go to therapy or anything.
Right, right.
We're just going to make these digs at each other and smoke cigarettes. Right, right. And so I thought the movie was really fascinating, funny. Scott, what did you think?
Yeah, I mean, it was a little tough to get into. Was the history of the family better known in Spain at the time? Because I feel like the film doesn't get into so much what you just talked about.
Well, yeah, and that's why when I've been screening it, I've been giving about a 5-minute introduction, because yeah. I think they don't, in the movie, they never tell you Leopoldo Panero, the father who's dead, was a communist and became a fascist.
Right,
you,
exactly.
You start intuiting.
Like, I got that he like had some fascist ties, yeah. clearly, but that was about the extent of it.
But also yeah. that even after his fascist ties, he was still, would sometimes, I guess, get under Franco's skin because he was like communicating with the leftist poets and stuff who had right. been yeah. exiled.
Because yeah, he wasn't sort of completely black and white in okay. terms of
yeah, and that comes
bad,
up
I'm in, yeah. You know, they're bad, I'm good, and yeah. It, so he yeah he that's why it's interesting. He's kind of a smudgy, difficult figure, mm-hmm. and so people did know who he was. I think he was starting to fall in obscurity then, but I think the film then it debuted in Madrid and then mm-hmm. started getting more attention. So I think it was rippling out. And then when it started appearing at regional theaters, people were sort of, the story of the family was getting revived.
Yeah.
yeah. But it is, you know, it's almost like I wish I could do an annotated version sure. of the film, because there's so many cultural references. I've seen it so many times now, and I know every single reference, but it's taken a while.
Yeah, yep. I mean, I read your article in Believer, and it was very helpful in terms of elucidating a lot of this. But one of the interesting things that found that you mentioned is that it started as a short film, and
right.
you kind of get that feeling of he just got carried along with
yeah,
the
yeah.
depth of the story. That it seems very casual at the start, but it just keeps unfolding in weirder and weirder ways, and they keep making these offhanded remarks. You're like, wait, suddenly there's incest, perhaps?
yeah. It really sneaks. Yeah, like yeah. the incest stuff. Sort of like, well, what are they talking about?
Yeah.
One of the things I found funny, unless I'm mistaken, I don't think there's any one shot where the mother and all three of the sons are on right. screen at the
yeah.
same time.
Yeah, there's strict rules. Or Leopoldo Maria and the middle son, Juan Luis, the first son, refused to appear on camera together. And at first, the mother didn't want to appear with any of them where it wasn't scripted in some way. And
oh, wow.
I think Gret, because I mean, I think they were all very aware that there was going to be competing narratives. And,
yeah.
you know, they'd all spent how many meals together shouting over each other
yeah.
and, or, you know, getting burned in yeah. front of the others. So I think they all were very cautious. But then, you know, we can talk about later, but that climactic scene in the school where the sons went to the Italian Lyceum, then you see it yeah, all comes out.
The when mother
you
put and the two together. Younger sons.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very long
yeah.
Sequence. Yeah, it's fantastic. Now, you mentioned earlier that the movie was popular in Spain. In what way? Like, is it a cult hit?
It is a cult okay. hit. You know, I think nowadays it's for, you know, kind of literary people or film people.
Okay.
Or people who are kind of, you know, interested in cultural stuff, and then they'll catch it and be like, whoa. Because it plays on the Spanish national television usually maybe twice a year. I mean, it's still, you know, is you can always find DVDs of it. And okay. people are always writing about the family on blogs. And it's just kind of, I'm trying to think, you know, I would think it's more well-known than Grey Garden. You know, Grey Gardens here, I okay. think, is really only among, you know, okay. cinephiles for the most part these days.
I guess now Broadway people know it, right?
Right, yeah,
yeah, sure. A musical or something?
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But so, Well, they should make a Pinedo musical.
I'm looking at the guy who needs to write that.
but yeah, so it's famous in the sense of cult famous. And in the moment when it came out, it was kind of a scandal. So I think I'm trying to think of a comparison for that. But it kind of had this big flash when it came out of upsetting people.
What were people upset about?
So, yeah, it came out in 1976, where Spain went through this 3-year transition from Franco died in 1975, and they didn't establish democracy until 1978. This came out in 1976, and so it was a moment where people were really kind of battling, trying to figure out the future of Spain, but that so much of the future of Spain had to do with the past of how are we going to deal with, you know, war criminals who are still alive and even on both sides and want to be involved in the political process. How do we talk about the dead father figure Franco, who repressed, you know, cultural memory, and there was, you know, kind of imposed a certain version of history. So all that stuff was kind of boiling beneath the surface. And then the film El Desencanto was read very metaphorically, because it's, you have the children of a dictatorial father who has died, and now they're talking about the legacy and the meaning of the family and talking about the past without really any reservation. So people read it as, well, I mean, there's also just cultural mores, like, you know, don't talk bad about the dead, don't talk bad about the father, these deeply embedded Spanish values. Right. So they were sort of violating all this stuff, and then it felt like this really, some people really, a really sacrilegious display of what they did, and other people, I think it felt like this huge release valve, where it was like, okay, finally people are talking about the rottenness that all of us have lived with for so long. Because I mean, the Banidos, they talk about so many taboos. Like, I would say the biggest taboo, which I think even today is really, people are really uncomfortable with, is suicide, which comes out throughout the whole film and suicide attempts. Obviously incest still a taboo, but they're more playing with it in a literary way. They weren't actually incestuous. They just like to talk about being attracted to their mom, which is still, I mean, that's still pretty,
it's still strange, yeah, but yeah, it's so offhanded that you're like, how deep does this go?
But then, you know, but them also talking about drug use, about, you know, political protests and being thrown in jail and solitary confinement and, you know, insanity. It was, you know, pretty wild stuff to be talking about. So without inhibition in 1976 in Spain, the year after a repressive Catholic dictator dies.
So the parts that I guess the cult fans of it find funny today,
right?
Was it seen as that at the, were the people laughing at the time?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. You know, I think a certain, you know, probably young people. Okay. I think because, you know, in my book, I reconstruct the opening in this theater in Madrid, and it's from interviews with a bunch of people who were there, the way I reconstructed, and a lot of them were Michi, the youngest son's friends, and, you know, okay, they talk about that as like a really joyous occasion and how happy Michi was. So I think you probably had, on the one hand, people laughing, and then there was other people who were friends more of Leopoldo Panero in from that generation, who were leaving the theater during the premiere because they were so offended.
Do you know why the family agreed to do this? Because they come across at once like very unguarded and also like they've thought about saying all of this their entire lives.
Yeah, that's
so a great, it's point. A really, well, strange energy. I mean,
that first interview between, that's the older brother and the youngest.
Yeah,
where they're actually talking about the film. Film.
It's meta, basically, from the first moment they're talking about, because originally Leopoldo Maria, the middle son, who ends up being sort of the star of the film, he didn't want to do the film. So this, and like you said, this film started as a 20-minute short. They did this first filming in August of 1974. Then they took a break. They felt like there was more to do, and so then you see they start filming later. Their hair has,
changed out.
Yeah, so they film kind of on and off for a year and a half. So and then Leopoldo Maria, the middle brother, ends up getting involved. But that, there's this, you know, great scene at the start where they're, Michi and Juan Luis are drunk and talking really fast and gesturing
wildly.
And they're talking about what it means that Leopoldo Maria isn't in the film. And of course, then he ends up being in the film. So yeah, it's interesting that they break down the fourth wall right away, and then it almost seems like the fourth wall gets erected.
So I kind of stepped on Scott's question. Why did they agree?
Why did they agree? I think partly for money. They did get paid.
Okay.
And it's interesting. They ended up winning some. Everyone knew it was a documentary, but they ended up winning an acting award that year because I guess the award didn't distinguish between
performance,
yeah, exactly, which right. I think is probably it's kind of cool in the sense of being more honest about we act like documentaries don't have an element of performance, and so many do,
especially with these type of
personalities,
artistic,
who are very aware of self-presentation. I think partly they did it for money part. And I think so. Michi had always wanted, he kind of was like a college dropout. He did a bunch of different majors, but he was kind of like he had too high opinion of himself and was like too good looking to ever like finish a degree.
Right? That's the youngest son. Keep him off street. That's the youngest son. Okay.
Yeah. That's the youngest son. So he loved film, and he later became a television critic for a newspaper. So he always wanted to make a film about some of his mother's old stories. And so there was kind of that idea planted, and there's some ambiguity about how the film actually started. This and kind of who suggested it to who, but somehow between Michi, Elias Querejeta, who is a producer who did, Spirit of the Beehive and, most of these legendary Spanish films from that time, and then Jaime Echavarri, the director, somehow it kind of came into being. And I think the family did it partly because they were already kind of a bit obsessed with their legacy, their mythology, and they saw this as an opportunity to tell their story. And I don't think they necessarily knew how far down the rabbit hole they were going to go, because partly at one point they stopped filming when they were close to the end because they're rank exhibitionists completely, I've been calling them the pre-Kardashian Kardashians.
Yeah.
And yet there was a moment where, they've been in Astorga filming for a while in this old family house and drinking a lot. And there was a moment where they felt like they had gone too far and they'd been tricked into saying too much and with no inhibition, and they just felt uncomfortable with it, and they kind of freaked out with it. Jaime Echavarri, the director, so Elias Querejeta had to come and kind of do, I guess, what a producer does, which is just get things, the production back on track. So I think they were dancing back and forth between having control, not having control, and same for Jaime, the director, who I've spent a lot of time with, and he still has very vivid memories of this, of making this movie.
Okay, well, that you just mentioned the director, that brings me to the next thing I wanted to ask. So it was the actual process of that you underwent to get it to the U.S.
Right.
Why was it never distributed in the U.S.? Probably because it's too.
I don't know though, because it's like so many odd movies. At least maybe don't. A lot of odd movies, maybe they never get to be shown in theater, but they end up in, Criterion or something. So to me, it is a little mysterious about why it never happened. Cause actually the last couple of years, it's been playing at different film festivals, like Copenhagen International Film Festival, just played Lisbon somewhere else. And like people are loving it because it's like this rumor that people have heard about, So I don't know. Jaime, the director, has the theory that because one time we were talking, I called him an auteur, and he was like, "Oh, you're one of the people who call me an auteur," because he's like, "I've done a lot of movies for hire." Uh-huh. So a lot of people don't see me that way. I've written some of my own films. I've done stuff for a payday. And so his theory was because he didn't, the film didn't kind of fit within lifetime cinematic vision that maybe the Criterion would have acquired his whole body of work and it all presented some kind of coherent aesthetic. He thought that was part of the reason why it never got picked up. But I'm not sure exactly.
So what was your process?
My process was, loved the film, wrote the Believer article, And the Believer article made me feel like, okay, you know, Believer's a cool magazine. It's got this small but passionate fan base of people who are like in, like you guys, who are into weird shit like this and can and can get into it. So I felt like, you know what, I want to share this with more weirdos like me. I think there's at least 1,000 of them in the U.S. or more. And so I actually first contacted the, so Jaime gave me the email of the guy who owns it, who is Enrique Cerezo, who's the owner of the Madrid Atletico soccer team. Oh. So he's just an incredibly rich guy who owns 70% of Spanish cinema.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So what his story is, I think from what Jaime said, told me he owned a video store. I don't know when this was, 40, 50 years ago. And then just realized that all of these Spanish movies, no one owned them anymore, or the rights, you could buy the rights for like $5. So he just started buying and buying and buying, and now, you know, he owns a soccer team. Uh-huh. and 70% of Spanish Spanish cinema. So I got in touch with his company, and we kind of went back and forth for several years of like, they could tell that I was passionate about this. Obviously it wasn't going to be a big payday for them. You know, I didn't want to take that much risk in acquiring it. So we went back and forth. And then finally, when the year before the book was coming out, so I guess this was just last year, 2018, I kind of was like, okay, I'm finally ready to cough up a bit of money. Can we be realistic about, uh-huh. I mean, I'm all I'm really going to do is be using it to get the word about my book and showing it weird places here and there. So we came to an agreement, and then, yeah. And then I know nothing about the digital side of things or the distribution or anything. So I just kind of have been figuring it out. And luckily, you know, a lot of people have been really open to, I've shown it to, you know, Film Forum in New York, at the Roxy in Philadelphia, that's coming up in the Roxy in San Francisco. I showed it this great place called Zotropolis in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, really cool place. And there's been, you know, the Film Forum screening was almost full, which was great. And the others have been sort of screenings of maybe 40 people, but really engaged. And then there's some screenings without me. Last night it played at the MoCA Jacksonville. Tomorrow it's playing at the Cleveland Museum of Art. So when I can, when I can go there, I'm going to do kind of introductions and Q&As. And then when I can't, I send a little video of me. It's like kind of giving the spiel that I gave you guys. Yeah.
So these screenings that you have been to,
yeah,
what are the American audiences responding to the most?
Right. Yeah. So Film Forum was the first screening, and that was, well, the most gratifying because it was the first one. There was such a big crowd. There was a line out the door before it started, and I gave a little introduction, you know, providing some of this context. And they definitely got it in the sense of like, there's stuff to laugh at, you know, and there's stuff to squirm at. And, mm-hmm. you know, obviously the squirming and the laughter are often the same thing. So, you know, they got a kick out of, you know, each of the members of the family is a character, and they're very, you know, especially Juan Luis, the oldest son, who said in his memoir, he said something like, my family was making a psychodrama, and I was trying to make cinema. So he's very, you know, clearly putting on a mask and playing a character, but they're all so aware of self-presentation that they're all characters. So people just got a kick out of some of the ridiculous things they say, and just the, you know, it was really, there's some fun moments of seeing, like, oh, I hadn't realized how hilarious that is. Like when they're Leopoldo Maria, the middle son, who's, you know, been in jail and mental institutions and used drugs, and he's just kind of a mess. He says something to his mother like, you know, well, I think I'm a complete failure, but I also think failure is the most resplendent victory. and then she goes, yeah, and I agree. And then everyone cracked up. So there was a couple moments like that where, you know, I knew when, you know, when Juan Luis talks about he how it turned him on to be confused, you know, that a waiter thought he was his mother's gigolo. And that turned him on sexually, you know, like I knew people would laugh at that because it's like, what is going on here? And the you know, and the crazy that first conversation that opens a movie where they're outside drinking and they're just yelling at each other and gesturing. I knew people would find that funny, and they did.
The funniest to me, and I talked about it, people who listened to the movie journal episode when I started watching the movie, the part with the oldest son giving the inventory of the things that he carries on his person all the time,
which he calls fetishes.
That part was so funny.
The
switch thing, which has saved my life twice. No more explanation. And then the reason he likes F. Scott Fitzgerald. Which, if you didn't listen to the episode, it's because F. Scott Fitzgerald is an alcoholic like myself, who had a horrible wife like myself.
So people got a kick out of that. And then, you know, it was satisfying too at the end, because there is this climactic scene where Leopoldo Maria confronts his mother really quite abrasively about mistakes he feels that she made about putting him in a mental institution, how she responded to that, and then her defending herself, saying, you know, well, I was out of my depth as a mother that come up in another age. You guys were doing things that we didn't do, and I didn't know how to do it. It's a really intense scene, and all the screenings, it's like you can feel the audience's whole focus just narrow in on that movie. Because I think Jaime, the director, does an interesting thing there, is it gets like kind of boring for about 2 minutes before that. Because they're talking about like childhood games they used to play. And you start to get a little bit antsy of like, okay, like it's losing interest a little bit. And then all of a sudden it's like the beating heart of the movie appears. And in each screening, I could feel the audience is just like getting pulled in, and it got super quiet, and people are realizing, oh my God, there's this really powerful confrontation of a family sort of, you know, battling its demons here. And that was really cool to see.
Yeah. I mean, some of that stuff, that like the failure line you brought up, reminded me of like a Max Fisher thing in Rushmore, or Noah Baumbach line, which totally have the similar energy, where it's like funny for a while until it gets real.
Right.
And
absolutely.
So, I mean, especially for a New York audience, I feel like that's kind of catnip.
That's true.
So to what extent, I mean, Jaime Chavarri, is that how you say it?
Yeah.
I know my accent is not very good. I mean, obviously he's a talented, smart, self-aware guy, so he knew that what he was putting on film was funny. But the parts you talked about, the gigolo thing, or basically everything I've said, including, oh, there's a story about puppies that is shockingly pitch blackly kind of funny.
People laughed at that, too.
In 1976, the dark parts of those, of that comedy, must have been even darker,
like, and more uncomfortable.
So, I mean, was he trying to be provocative in that way?
I think he was. I don't know if he was trying to be provocative, but there was no way he couldn't be provocative and make a movie about the Pinedo family. So it was sort of like he knew this was provocative stuff, but it kind of. It all was. And I think his thing was, he was just trying to figure out the order of everything. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you know, again, filmed over a year and a half. I think he lost a sense of things, and he had to go through, I don't know, 6 or 8 hours of footage. And then, you know, it's kind of like a linear movie that isn't really linear. It gives you a linear sense. There's a feeling of progression, but at the same time, it's all fragments.
They're jumping around so much from like different eras in their lives.
Right.
And then like they'll go from childhood to them being in prison. It's like, wait, are these two like happening side by side where they're thrown into prison as children? Which they feel like they kind of were when they talk about their school upbringing and stuff.
No, it's really, so I think Jaime was really just trying to figure out the best way to make it all coherent in some ways. And I think for him, probably the whole thing had lost the humor, actually, because he was so sick of the Pinedo family. It's just like, because, you know, they made a follow-up, a kind of Where Are They Now documentary 20 years later about the family. And, you know, he had the opportunity to make it, and he was not. He did not want to go on the Pinedo, ride the Pinedo bull again.
Well, I'm going to come back to that. But I want to stick to... I worry... sometimes with movies like this, or Great Gardens or like American Movie, like these funny documentaries. Right. Sometimes, and it's not my business how other people are, well, the morality of how other people are enjoying right. something. But sometimes I wonder, are people laughing at like is it a bit mean spirited mm-hmm. or callous to laugh at this? I'm just being self-serving by right. saying like, no, I can laugh because I also empathize or whatever.
Right, right.
I don't know if you've how that element, that sort of Schadenfreude element,
right,
plays with the Spanish audience and with the American audience. They're different.
I think you know that kind of feeling bad about laughing is maybe when you see you're laughing at someone's vulnerability, and I think that's uncomfortable. But there's something about the Pinedos that they invite it because they're just poking you in the eye or poking Spanish culture, and they're pretending
or like, each other,
yeah, yeah, or each other, and they're pretending they're not vulnerable in right. a sense. So I don't think there's a cruel laugh. Okay. That's how I feel. I don't think there's a cruel laughter in the audience, and because I think it's sometimes it's so tongue in cheek. Like the incest stuff is total tongue in cheek. Uh-huh. It's like, come on, like I don't mean this, but isn't it funny that I say, you know, yeah. I want to have sex with my mom? That's how I feel. That it's provocative, but you know,
yeah, that reminds me of now I'm forgetting the director's name, but the comedy, that movie with Tim Heidecker a few years ago.
Yeah, speaking of an uncomfortable movie.
Yeah, but yeah. That character feels like he could come from God. The same sort of primordial stuff as these about guys. That.
You are so right. Like, he could have...
Yeah.
He's like a Pinero descendant. You're completely right.
Okay, so speaking of that, I want to hear about this follow-up documentary, and yeah. just... I don't want to give away too much of your book, but right. what's up with the Pineros in 2019?
Right, right. Well, yeah, so the documentary was made 20 years later, and it was basically Michi again was the engine behind it. And I think it was like he was sort of broke, he was kind of fading into cultural forgetting, and he kind of wanted to be relevant again. And so he called Jaime, said like, why don't you make a movie with me? And then Jaime, before he was like, all right, let me think about it. And then while he was thinking about it, Michi called up another director, Ricardo Franco, and was like, hey, do you want to make a movie about me? And then Ricardo was like, oh, let me check with Jaime first. He calls Jaime and is like, Michi called me to offer me a movie. And Jaime was like, well, he called me too. And so he's like, fuck these guys, I'm not making this movie. So Ricardo Franco's you know very also respected director, he made it, but it's a completely different movie. It's dedicated to Jaime Echauri because it was sort of like, you know, it is the sequel in a certain sense, but basically it's like a very poetic and very depressing where are they now. And it's just sort of like, well, they're not in a good place. Like, they're at least when they made the Desencanto, they were sort of young and full of fire, and you know,
yeah, the sun's at least.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Kind of doomed, but there's some, you know, when you're doomed when you're a young person, it's like sexy. When you're doomed when you're like 50, you know, it was basically sort of like Leopoldo Maria is sort of like if Jim Morrison had gotten to be, you know, 50, and no one, like,
that's the middle son.
Yeah. Okay. No yeah. one wants to see Jim Morrison
yeah.
when he's 50. It's like, you know, or Jimi Hendrix, like all these people died at age 27 for the cultural, the myths that grow up around them. 27 is the perfect age to die. But instead, this is like, imagine a documentary made about them when they're all like, you know, just destroyed by hard living. You know, their myths are starting to, you know, get a little grisly around the edges. So that's what you see, is that where they are now is they're middle aged, and
yeah,
and there's the history in the past weighs on them a lot. It's still got some beautiful moment. It's called After So Many Years.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that's so interesting about the original is, and they even talk about this, that they feel like in biologically in their family, they're not designed to work. Yeah, it's yeah, very exactly. clear throughout the movie that they have nowhere to be. It's like most documentaries, you get a sense that people are using the documentary as an extension to their job, and they like dress up well, and right. they like put on a show to make it seem like they have something going on. It's very clear these people could go weeks and no one would think, yeah. no one really missed them.
Yeah, but yeah.
Unlike the Beals, like they do look cool. Like there's right. a certain like
sure, there's a little type fashion of, like,
yeah,
yeah.
So they probably still go out yeah. and like yeah. party. But and, like and,
well they had that aristocratic or, you know, kind of literary scenester
sure, yeah.
look, but yeah, they didn't want to work because it was sort of like they were above that. And none of them really, I mean, they well, Leopoldo Maria mostly lived in psychiatric asylums his whole life. Yeah. And then Michi, you know, he made some money as a film critic and this and that, but he drank it all away.
Yeah.
And I do think like making El Desencanto got him, you know, drinks paid for years and years.
Michi is the youngest. Yeah, I can't keep them straight. I was fascinated by his chain smoking specifically because he's wearing clothes that I'm sure like he's like sitting on nice couches, right, like antique furniture and wearing probably like a, in $1975, a $400 sweater.
Right,
and
right.
I'm like, don't be careful with your act. But it's like, it makes him cooler.
Exactly.
Quote unquote cooler that he doesn't care about. But I imagine 20 years later that if he's still chain smoking, that's probably not as cool.
Yeah. He's in really rough shape, but it's still a cool movie in its own right. And I have no idea who owns the rights. I've thought about figuring out.
Oh, it's part of the other 30%.
Maybe, or I think it's kind of like lost, but I'd be interested in sometime bringing it out.
So I want to get to other questions, but that reminded me of something I wanted to know. And this could be very dry for some of the listeners, but the thing that you're showing, it's a DCP.
Mm-hmm.
And is that the soccer guy, what's his name?
Cerezo. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that he just had a DCP or did you have to like scan something?
Actually, this was I should give full props to Film Forum here. So the Spanish producer through this, through his Aspera, there's sort of a large file transfer service.
Aspera.
So they transferred it. I think it was, MOV file to Film Forum. Film Forum was generating a DCP so they could show it, and then they just gave me the DCP.
So, this isn't. There was no new restoration with the soccer guy.
No, or done. I think they did restore it. I think maybe before they reissued the DVD a couple of years ago.
Oh, I see. Okay, so you're going from that. Yeah. All right,
because it looks great. I should say,
It's
a great looking film to begin with, but the digital file is really high quality.
Yeah,
it is great looking in a way that it's there's something mundane about so much of it. It's just people talking.
Then every now and then there's this camera move where like light's pouring in from the back. Camera's like moving, which you don't see in a lot of documentaries that there's interviews. So it's
there's a couple
kinda,
it
gives it kind of like
shots,
some romanticism to it.
It's really interesting. When Michi's the last scene, I think, or one of the last scenes when Michi's talking about if they'll reproduce, if the bloodline's going to die out, and he's sitting smoking in this kitchen in his sweater and the camera starts moving away and it's, you know, like, it's like the family is dying out. He's getting smaller. And there's a lot of shots like that that are very well done.
The bookend shots of the as yet unveiled statue, which looks eerie because it looks like a corpse or something. Yeah.
Well,
you know?
In your review, right, you said something like, you know, the statue of the father could have been a statue of Franco, and it's really well put. And and I think that was one of the things that kind of made the metaphor clear to Spanish audiences, because who have they been seeing statues of for decades,
right?
You know, Franco among other generals, and then here's this statue of the father.
So did the Panero's reproduce?
They died out. The prophecy that they put out in the Desencanto in 1976 came true, and they never had any heirs. So there are some cousins, distant cousins, who have inherited the estate, but the kind of this romantic idea of the line dying out, and you know, they reference the Wittelbach family, which was this Bavarian.
Oh, right,
why I wish I could annotate the whole movie, because in that scene in the garden where Michi and Juan Luis are yelling at each other, he's like, you know, you're playing at being a Wittelbach. He's like, I'm not a fucking Wittelbach. And you know, and they're going back and forth. And so the first time I saw it, I was like, what are they talking about? Like, who are the Wittelbach? And then, of course, you know, and that again, they're playing with this whole idea of like, you know, they're aristocrats talking about European royalty. You know, they love to like add that mystique to everything. Uh-huh. So by comparing themselves, you know, instead of just being like, we're impotent because we drank too much, they're like, we're like Bavarian kings, you know? And that's what I think of almost the whole, what you see on display in the whole film is this reaching towards literary cultural references to elevate their own meaning, which is something I actually in a sense admire about them, because I think, how do we all, like, you know, infuse meaning to our lives when it's just like life is so banal and you know, prosaic, and then how it's only in the stories we tell about ourselves that things become a little, seem to have more meaning.
Yeah, in that scene, actually, they reference, I think one of them tries to like himself to Ludwig more than the other guy, which made me think of Visconti in general, in terms of just telling stories about like the dying aristocracy.
Right.
And it seems like this is like the more genuine portrait, whereas Visconti still held on to like the romantic ideal. It seems like the director here saw through what they're trying to present themselves as, and just fell into the nitty gritty of it.
No, there is, there's something kind of like World War I-ish about kind of, or the themes in this movie about this dying off of supposedly noble people who are actually had a corrupt, you know, interior.
Is this Chavarri's best known film in Spain?
There's, I think it's translated Bicycles Are for Summer, which is a very well known one. And then he made Camarón a few years ago, which is a biopic about a very famous flamenco, kind of just amazing musician. It was kind of like he did this flamenco, like disco pop rock mix in the 70s and 80s, and it made a biopic of him. I think that came out in 2005 or something like that. That's also a well-known one, but he made a lot of films, and he appears in a couple Almodovar films acting. Cause like, you know, they were all in Madrid at the same time, and a lot of them acted in each other's movies.
So where can people see El Desencanto?
Where can people see El Desencanto?
Or where can people find out where to see El
Desencanto? So they can go to my website, aaronshulman.com. That's S-H-U-L-M-A-N. That's where I have the screenings listed, and I add, you know, there's always seem to be more appearing. And for anyone who's in L.A., there's a screening at UCLA next week on May 9th at 7:30 p.m. in the Darren Star screening room. And then I'm
really named after I didn't know Darren Star had a screening room.
Well, he's got money, so he's got a screening room. And
that's so, that is, I hate when people say only in LA, but that seems so LA for Darren Star to have a screening room.
And then I'm hoping to have another screening at a bigger venue, maybe this summer, or the fall, or next spring, but I'm still
here
working
in Los Angeles.
Yeah, yeah.
But well, there are more rolling out.
There's, let's see, I've got San Francisco May 30th, Santa Barbara May 19th. Yeah, Detroit, I think, is coming together June 22nd, East Lansing June 23rd. I'm still trying to figure out. Chicago, it's going to play at the Salvador Dali Museum in St. Petersburg, Florida in the fall. So yeah, there's, it's just going to be popping up. And then, I do have DVDs, but right now I'm just selling them to universities and institutions. So it's absurdly high price for me to try to make back the money on the rights.
Well, Scott, anything else?
No, this was great.
Yeah, thank you so much, Aaron, for
joining
us.
Thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it.
Again, the website is aaronshulman.com. All right.
And anything you want to know about the Bonetos in the film, you can find in my book. So
yeah,
that's my last plug. Age of Disenchantment.
And you can you go to battleshippretension.com. You can read my review of the movie. And you can read lots of other reviews, including this week, all kinds of stuff, nonfiction.
Great,
that interview, really great. Also references to Visconti in nonfiction. And Long Shot is out this week, which was a surprise to me. I've never been a Jonathan Levine fan. I think Long Shot's great.
All right.
Anyway, those reviews are up there. You can email me at david@battleshippretension.com. You can follow me on Twitter at @DavyPretension. Scott, where can people find you?
On Twitter at Rail of Tomorrow and at CriterionCast, where I posted my own review of nonfiction. And Battleship, of course.
Of course.
Of course.
Any Twitter or anything you want to plug?
Just A.M. Shulman.
A.M. Shulman. So thanks again for being here. This was a blast.
Thank you guys. This was great.
Definitely, if El Desencanto is coming to your city, make room for it. Check
or
it
if
out.
You want to organize a screening, I'm fine.
Yeah,
with,
for sure.
I'm fine with doing it just in people's living room. Really, to me, it's just about finding people who are passionate enough or will get it. So yeah, feel free to reach out.
Yeah, and then you sell some more books.
Yeah, exactly. that's the idea.
Well, thanks again for being here. Thank you at home for listening.
David will get you next time. I won't be here.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.